welcome to an episode of Blogging Heads, I guess. I'm Mike Goldfarb, online editor in the Weekly Standard, and joining me is...
Robert Farley, assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky.
Okay, well look, you've got the big piece in The Guardian today, so why don't you kick it off and tell us a little bit about your piece and where you're coming from on it.
Well, I have a short piece in The Guardian, so yesterday, of course, was the big news. That was not unexpected, I think, from any section.
Well, wait, if I can just jump in, I would like to take credit. This news was broken on the Weekly Standard blog. We were the first to report the trip by Ellen Tauscher to Europe to break the bad news to our allies there, our former allies. But please continue. Now that I've given myself a pat on the back.
Congratulations, and we can talk about that quote unquote former at greater length. So yesterday, the big news was broken by the Weekly Standard that a 6-month review had been completed by the Obama administration with regards to the deployment of a missile radar, or of a radar and a set of potential missile interceptors in Poland and the Czech Republic. And it turns out that yesterday around midnight, President Obama called the interim prime minister of the Czech Republic and indicated that it was a no-go, that the United States would not be deploying the radar and the interceptors to Europe, to Eastern Europe, and instead would be deploying them somewhere else. Tried to explain to the Poles the same thing, but apparently they refused to take Hillary's call. And so that had led yesterday to a giant Twitter foo fest and really a lot of ink spilled on every part of the ideological spectrum about the utility of missile defense. But
that's
very exciting.
That's a pretty good summary.
Right.
Yes. So look, you make the case this morning in The Guardian that this was a great step toward a sane foreign policy, I think, was the way you described it. Mm-hmm. I think why don't you make the case first here for why this was the correct decision, and then I can make the case against.
All right. Well, the first argument would be from the technical characteristics of the missile defense systems. The systems that were being deployed to the Czech Republic and Poland were a little bit behind the times, especially given sort of the latest developments in sea-based missile defense. They were a little bit more expensive than the sea-based missile defense, and they were certainly far less mobile than the sea-based missile defense. They were also geared towards a different kind of missile than what, you know, everybody says that the country that we're orienting towards. It's hard to say. Actually, yesterday, everybody was saying that the country we were orienting this towards was Russia. But, you know, 3 years ago, everybody was saying it was Iran. In any case, we found out the Iranians really are far behind on this particular kind of missile, on ICBMs, which this missile defense system would have protected against. They're ahead on medium and intermediate range missiles, but they're behind on ICBMs. And so from the technical characteristics, it was sort of a no-brainer. I mean, the sea-based missile defense does much better, is cheaper, and has less of a political footprint. The second question was important to me, was relevant to me, was the question of whether we were supporting our allies. And on that particular issue, and I know that you found this pretty important, I sort of, you know, looked at the polls in the Czech Republic and the polls in Poland. And both of them indicate pretty strong popular majorities against the deployment of this system. In Poland, when during the height of the Georgia War, there was a popular majority against deploying the system. Now, you know, it's a democratic country, and every democratic country has democratic procedures, and so the government that's in power right now wanted the system. But the fact that, say, you know, 70% of Czechs think this is a terrible idea indicates to me that the government that wanted the system may not be the government very long. And in fact, in the Czech Republic, the government that wanted the system is no longer the government. So I'm sort of untouched by the argument that we are betraying our allies. And finally, of course, there's the Russia question and the issue of whether this sends a note of appeasement, as I think you've suggested, to the Russians, that the United States will just roll over. And I guess my argument would be here that, you know, not every single foreign policy act that the United States embarks upon should be evaluated based on what the Russians think. If the Russians were an entirely happy, friendly, freedom-loving, cheerful country, and I'm sure there are cheerful Russians, I would argue for exactly this same policy. that the Russians fall short in some of the happy cheery aspects doesn't change the fact that I am arguing for this policy. And so that is why I think this is a sane foreign policy, a sane foreign policy maneuver.
Okay. Those are for the most part the arguments that the Obama administration is making. And so I guess the first thing I would respond to that is, you know, you make the case that this system is the system that was being deployed in Poland is a little bit behind the times. In fact, the White House has put out a fact sheet that says that really their hope for this system is that the final SM-3 missiles would be in place. And everyone is assuming this is Turkey where these missiles are going to be. There's no evidence that Obama's actually opened any kind of negotiations with the Turks or that that's it, that he's gotten approval there for this kind of system. But if there is a land-based SM-3 component, people are assuming it would be in Turkey and that this would be to address the short- and medium-range threat, which the Obama administration considers more pressing at the moment. I would submit to you that by 2020, when they plan to have that system in place, why do we think that 11 years from now the Iranians aren't going to have ICBMs? Why do we think that 5 years from now they're not going to have ICBMs? Obama kept saying this is a 21st century solution to face 21st century threats. But in fact, looking into the future, this is the threat of the future. That's my problem with this idea that, you know, this system was geared toward a different missile threat, maybe toward the North Korean threat, because these are the same interceptors that were placed in Alaska. That's clearly the direction that the Iranians are going in. Everyone suspects there's been real cooperation between the Norks and the Iranians. Mm-hmm. I just find that, that seems based on a lot of assumption to me that by 2020, when we have the system set up, if that in fact comes to pass, because as we know, this was a huge amount of negotiation to get these into the Polish and Czech sites, and it's a very complicated diplomatic dance.
There was a tremendous amount of, I think the word you're using is bribery. We engaged in a tremendous amount of bribery to get the Poles, especially, to agree.
We
promised them Patriot missile systems. We promised them, really generous lease terms in terms of the sites that we were leasing, and really generous construction terms for Polish construction.
Helicopters and aircraft,
right,
et cetera. Although
and the bribery is going forward. We are continuing to bribe the Poles now for not deploying the system. So, I think Obama
is
fairly
clear on that.
And I'm
for a foreign policy of bribery. I'm quite comfortable with that. I like having F-16s in Eastern Europe. I like having Patriot missiles in Eastern Europe. I like having, U.S. defense presence in Eastern Europe. I think that's just common sense to me. But the other thing I wrote down here, and I note in your piece, you note the 70% opposition in the Czech Republic. It was a much tougher sell there. Poland, that was not so much the case, and I didn't see a poll number included in your piece this morning. But my understanding is that, and I haven't looked at the numbers myself, my understanding is that public opposition in Poland was much less.
Public opposition in Poland was less. At the height of the Georgia crisis, the polling ran about, if I recollect, and it was on one blog this morning, it was 46 to 41 against the system. And this was in the midst of the Russia-Georgia war. And it peaked there. Support for the system peaked there and has since declined.
But the United States invested tremendous political capital in achieving this, in getting these agreements, and getting these sites.
You see, that's what the fabulous thing is.
But the governments there, as you say, because there was public opposition to it, they put their own political futures on the line in order to advance this. And now what do they have to show for it? You know, they went to bat, and now we're pulling the rug out from under them. I think that sends a very, very bad message on cooperation in the future, because you know what? Obama may want to cooperate with the Turks, but who's to say Republicans won't come in and pull the rug out from under his feet on that? And you think it's going to be an easy sell in Turkey to put U.S. missile defense systems in there? That's going to be
frankly, Michael, I don't think that we're ever going to put missile defense systems in Turkey. I think that to the extent we're going to have missile defense systems, they are going to be off Turkey, and that they're almost all going to be sea-based missile defense systems, which have been the most successful part of the missile defense thus far. I think that the Obama administration is not being entirely honest when it's saying it's replacing the proposed land-based systems in Eastern Europe with a proposed land-based system in Turkey. And when I say not being entirely honest, I think think they're just lying, because I think their intent is to focus on sea-based missile systems. But, you know, I would also say, in terms of sort of what we talk about the credibility problem here, you know, the people who you know, sacrificed and fought hard in the Czech Republic are already out of office. So, you know, it's great. It's too bad. You know, that was unfortunate. But the current government doesn't seem to have much interest in this, and the Czech people don't seem to have much interest in this. And the government in Poland, you know, it can take back to its people the Patriot missile defenses. It can take back to its people all these contracts. It can take back to its people a whole set of other wonderful bonus things instead of a missile defense system that its people didn't want, right? I mean, the people didn't want the missile defense system. So the fact that the Polish government can get all the goodies without taking the missile defense system, I think actually be a huge win for the Polish government that's in power right now.
I think that's, you know, you can argue that either way, whether they're really going to pay a price for this government's out of power. I think the moral hazard argument, if I'm using that financial term correctly, and I don't follow finance, so forgive me if I'm not, but sort of the idea that, you know, this sets a really bad precedent. When you have administrations, and you've seen it in the Middle East as well with Israel, where there's, you know, is Obama honoring Bush administration agreements on settlement freezes? There's becoming a question whether one administration's word is good when a new administration comes to town.
Right.
And I think that's a troubling problem.
Well, I guess my first response, I mean, on the settlement question is that administration should not honor secret promises. Right? I mean, should actually be
I don't want to get into honoring secret promises.
But on the question of and you wrote quite a bit yesterday. I mean, everybody was writing a lot. Matt Duss was writing a lot. Sort of the Ackerman Iglesias mafia, so forth, was writing a lot. All the security people were writing a lot. And you wrote that this is a political decision on part of the Obama administration, that it's not driven by military considerations. And I guess I found that a little bit curious because it seems to me, and sort of I think this is how a lot of people interpreted it back in 2003, 2004, 2005, when they were bandying about the idea of deploying the system, that, you know, putting the system in Eastern Europe was a political maneuver. It was intended to lock future administrations into a particular stance on missile defense. And the idea of locking them into this would be to say, well, look, we have these agreements with these friendly governments in Eastern Europe, and they've already okayed having this missile defense. And so there was a political logic here that was driving, in fact, I think even beyond any sort of military technical consideration about Iranian nuclear or Iranian ICBMs, or even certainly Russian ICBMs. And so, you know, it's politics all the way down, right? The intention was to make exactly the kind of argument that you're making right now, right? That we'll do something that's, in my view, actually kind of stupid in order to force future administrations to do it. And so, in that sense, I'm really happy that the Obama administration has gone against this. I think it actually takes a lot of political courage to say no. I mean, listen, when you make an agreement
with an administration, then it's
not good if it's stupid for American foreign policy.
Look, there is a national security component to it. Look, you're absolutely right. There are multiple rationales for this system. One of them was having a presence in Eastern Europe. The other one, though, and I think the real problem with what Obama's doing, and I see this across the board in the way he's managing defense procurement, is he is taking the investments that have been made in the past and holding that up as, oh, you know, see, we have the capacity and the capability, and we don't need these futuristic, expensive, unproven systems. And on the same hand, one day not so long ago, the SM-3 was an unproven system. Mm-hmm. If Obama had been president in 2000 and had made the same sort of decisions about missile defense in 2000, we would not have the very systems that he today is saying, well, let's rely on these proven systems. Mm-hmm. Missile defense, they made a decision that they, instead of as most Pentagon programs are done, proving the system, testing the system, and then deploying it, they made a decision to deploy and test simultaneously and try and build the system out and develop the system at the same time. And they did this because it was so sophisticated, so complicated, nobody had ever done anything like it before. And so, you know, the question is, this was part of that development. Was it going to be the most effective thing? Is the Alaska thing, do we really trust those Alaska interceptors if a North Korea missile is fired? Not really. I mean, I wouldn't want to rely on it. But at the same time, that's what it's there for. I mean, that's what it's there for, and you hope that sort of as you build this out and as you develop it, you get more and more reliable. And look, you know, there was a time when they said you can't hit a bullet with a bullet, and right. they do that now routinely.
But
so this idea that unproven, they're creating this process by which nothing unproven will be deployed and nothing will be tested, so nothing will be proven. They are ideologically opposed to missile defense.
They're ideologically opposed because they think it's a terrible idea, and I'm happy that they're ideologically opposed because I think it's a terrible idea too. And when we say missile defense, we actually need to disaggregate here because I think that you're conflating two different objectives of missile defense here. And I think that this gets to the distinction between the sea-based SM or standard missile system that is actually deployable and has had some successes, and the system that's in Alaska and the system that would have been in Eastern Europe. When you think about missile defense, you can think about it in tactical and strategic, strategic view. And the strategic view is, more or less goes like this. If country X, rogue state X, decides to fire a bunch of nuclear missiles at us someday, it would be great if we had a missile defense system that could shoot down all those nuclear missiles. And that's, that would be awesome. I mean, and, then...
It'd be great if we had a missile defense system that could shoot 5% of those missiles down.
Well, in some sense it would be great, but it would also be strategically irrelevant, right? Unless you have a kill rate for a missile defense system against nuclear weapons, that's 99.9%. Then the missile defense system itself is strategically irrelevant. But I would argue
that the other way, but okay.
Well, I mean, we can argue that. We can discuss that. But let me make my point on tactical missile defense first. Tactical missile defense, which has also a fairly long history, and it has a history that goes back to the 1980s and has a history with the Patriot missile batteries and so forth, tactical missile defense has largely been intended to be used in theaters against conventional ballistic missile attacks. Conventional ballistic missile attacks like we saw in the Iraq War in 1991, like we saw in the Iran-Iraq War, like we saw actually in the war in Afghanistan, the Soviets used tactical ballistic missiles. And the missile defense systems that are used against tactical ballistic missile systems, actually have had success, and they actually do have tactical effect. And so I suspect that in 2000, if the Obama administration, or let's say the Gore administration, had had the chance, we probably would have seen them move forward with sea-based missile defense. I just doubt they would have moved forward with national missile defense like we have in Alaska and like we were purportedly going to have in Eastern Europe. So, I mean, I guess I disagree with sort of your premise. And the second thing, and we can talk about the fighters later, if we're really talking about proven versus unproven systems, then the Obama administration would never have canceled the F-22, right? I mean, we're going with a more unproven fighter in the F-35 than the F-22, right? I mean, the F-35 has not actually been deployed anywhere. And so, actually it seems like going with the F-35 is more forward-looking, given that it's sort of a more, its design train started much later than the F-22, that seems like a much more forward-looking move than...
And yet I will make the exact opposite argument regarding fifth-generation fighters. Mm-hmm. But I just think I want to get back on track on missile defense here. There's mm-hmm. the key right. point here, and that is the appeasement of Russia. Mm-hmm. And so you make the argument that, look, missile defense was bad, so let's drop it regardless. I would submit to you that that was the fundamental problem with Obama's approach with missile defense. Yes, the left opposes missile defense, thinks it's a waste of money, even though at the rate this government is spending money to argue over a few billion dollars seems outrageous to me when it comes to national security. But yes, they said it was a waste of money. And
I'm glad you're letting your fiscal conservatism show, but that's okay. You go.
I'm a neoconservative. We are mm-hmm. not fiscal conservatives for the mm-hmm. most part. But I would say here's the problem with that. The system existed, and it did antagonize the Russians. And so what did we get for it? What the hell did we get for getting rid of the system? Now, granted, they wanted to get rid of the system anyway, the Obama administration. But couldn't they play a little hard to get and try and get some concession from the Russians in exchange for what everyone on the left believes is the number one source of friction between these two countries? I think there is going to be a real problem for Obama if he is not able to deliver some concession from the Russians politically on the Iran issue. And the three plausible concessions, to my mind, that might be demanded are halting uranium shipments, nuclear fuel shipments to Bushehr, preventing them from delivering the S-300 air defense system to Iran, and helping with international sanctions. And Lavrov comes out last week and says, there's going to be no help on sanctions. Bibi was in Russia, and you know, everybody's hearing that he was told the S-300 is a done deal. And nobody seriously thinks that they would stop these shipments to Bushehr, because that would be like us pulling missile defense out of Poland. It sends a bad signal to the rogue regimes they like to do business with, that, you know, hey, you can get $10 billion deep into a project with us, and then we're going to pull the rug out from under you.
Well, actually, the Russians have no problem doing that. The Russians do that all the time. I mean, you know about the Russian carrier that they're rebuilding for the Indians, right?
Yeah, well, they're in a big dispute over I guess currency exchanges in that case.
Well, no, they promised him a free carrier if they bought a bunch of MiG-29s, and now they said, well, you can have the MiG-29s for the large price that you paid, and we'll need an extra $2 billion for the carrier. So the Russians have no problem with dealing with rogue regimes any way they feel like.
The point being, I think you're going to need to show some concession. Otherwise, I mean, look, why, and this was the problem, that the Obama administration signaled from the very beginning that it was one of their top priorities. Look, nobody doubted they were going to get rid of these systems. This did not come as a big surprise to Republicans or to our allies, probably. But the question was, weren't they going to at least try and, I mean, wouldn't that be the realist approach, the sane approach? If you're going to get rid of something, let's get something in exchange for it.
All right, well, I mean, two responses. First, the Russians would never make clear that there was a quid pro quo, and we would never make clear if there was a quid pro quo, if indeed an agreement had been come to. That's simply the way that these things operate, right? I mean, the Russians have their neoconservatives too, right? I mean, and I think
everybody is a bad guy around the world.
This point is skipped over. There are people who are telling Putin and Medvedev that if you make a deal on this missile defense, you will appear weak. You will be appeasing the Americans. Right. There are Russian foreign policy advisors who are making this argument to him right now. Right. They're making this argument to both of the major Russian policymakers, that if you let it appear that there was a quid pro quo, it will appear as if the Americans have won. Right. There are these people making this argument right now. So even if there's a quid pro quo,
neocons.
Well, fine. We call them whatever. Russian hawks. Russian foreign policy hawks.
I call them enemies of freedom. The people in this country who are making that case are doing it because they are concerned to see that democratic countries are this country stands by our democratic allies. I mean, there's a pretty big difference there,
right.
I would say.
What I'm saying, Michael, is that there is always a caucus in every country that's going to scream, appeasement, 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 every time you come to an agreement with somebody else, right? And you have exactly this caucus in Russia, and it is not difficult to understand at all why Medvedev and Putin aren't making explicit a quid pro quo. I don't know if there's been a quid pro quo. I do know that the Russians have become much more cooperative in terms of supply lines to Afghanistan, that they've been much more cooperative in terms of overflights, and that Putin the other day actually said something, you know, almost nice about the idea of an Israeli strike on the Iranian system, or on the Iranian nuclear facilities, which I think is a terrible idea anyway, but, you know, whatever. And there actually is the potential that there may be a quid pro quo here, but it would never, ever be public, because it would be seen as a act of weakness upon the Russians.
Well, it's going to have to be public. This was always a bargaining chip for the left.
What it will be is that the Russians down the road will say, well, you know, we sort of thought it was a bad idea anyway to sell the S-300 to Iran, and we reconsidered, and it had nothing to do whatsoever. You know, we've done a six-month review of this policy of sending uranium to Iran, and it turns out that, you know, this wasn't such a great idea anyway, and we don't feel bound by this agreement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? We will review this again at another future time. Right? That's how it will play out if there's actually a quid pro quo. Right?
Well, look,
the quid pro quo will not be public.
If Obama is able to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, just as if he is able to deliver a real peace deal in the Middle East, just as if he's able to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, look, if he achieves his goals, nobody's going to argue with the methods. But right now, it's very difficult to see how you get from here to there.
It's not difficult for me to see how you get from here to there. But my second point, and it has to do with the appeasement thing. I mean, in this case, this is essentially the situation that you are calling appeasement. In 2004, the United States, in 2004, 2005, the United States decides to deploy a missile system to Eastern Europe. It drives the Russians absolutely batshit, right? We are infuriating the Russians by building this system, right? Before that, I mean, we had our disagreements with the Russians, but this immediately became the biggest sticking point between us and the Russians, this missile system, based on a U.S. decision to deploy this system to Eastern Europe. Now, come 2009, when the United States changes its mind about deploying the system, you are telling me that the change in the mind constitutes appeasement.
Yes,
if that's
absolutely
true, that's really defining appeasement down, right? I mean, it's like punching someone in the face, and then when you stop punching them in the face, you are appeasing them.
I mean, look, isn't it the left that's making the case that this missile defense system is worthless and it doesn't do anything to undermine Russia's deterrent capability?
It could be the foundation of a much larger system that could potentially undermine aspects of Russia's security. But this is the other thing, right? I mean, ever since 2004, 2005, and if we're going to make blanket statements about the left and the right has consistently argued, and the Bush administration, which was sort of on the right, consistently argued that this missile system was not geared towards Russia. And yesterday, when I read the Weekly Standard, and when I read the National Review, when I read basically every single organ for the right, Russia, 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 Russia. Nothing about
that's
Iran.
Because, look,
Russia,
you,
Russia, Russia,
heard,
Russia,
it's
Russia.
About, it's about you believe that this system antagonized Russia. And
no, I believe the system is stupid. I believe the system is stupid and pointless, and that's why I want to cancel it. I wouldn't care about antagonizing Russia if I thought that the system had a point. You don't think it's going to antagonize Russia when we put destroyers in the Black Sea? Of course it will, but if it makes sense, then we'll do it, right?
There's not going to be any destroyers in the Black Sea.
Destroyers are in the Black Sea pretty regularly. A destroyer visited the Black Sea right after the Russia-Georgia war.
You're telling me, so your plan is you think that they're going to have a really active missile defense system in 2015 that's stationed all around
We deploy ballistic missile defense capable Arleigh Burke destroyers to the Black Sea on a fairly regular basis. So I kind of do think that.
I sort of doubt that, and I would this idea that you keep pushing that somehow these destroyers are out there with SM-3s that are ready to fire at missiles. I mean, that is not true. Each one of these missiles has to be, like, specially prepared. These SM-3s are actually, it's a huge investment. This technology does not actually exist right now. Yes, we knocked a satellite out of the sky the other year. But to sort of put this SM-3 out there in this sea-based missile defense system out there as though this is a proven technology, it's not. There is a huge amount of investment. I mean, that is why they have a four-phase approach that doesn't get finished till 2020.
I guess that we have a difference in opinion of what constitutes a proven technology, and I guess where one can be on the road to a proven technology, because sea-based missile defense is far, far, farther on the road to proven missile defense technology, to the extent that we have actually operationally deployed sea-based missile defense.
We have operationally deployed these ballistic missiles. They are considered operational in Alaska.
Yeah, but nobody thinks they work. You don't even think that they work. Right. I mean,
I
you just said that you don't
think
they were.
Nobody's seen an SM-3
I actually do think that the sea-based missile defense system does work. I actually think that it works. I actually think that it can take down theater missile defense or theater ballistic missiles. And I think that the evidence is pretty conclusively demonstrated that it can do so. Do I think it can take down 100% of them? No, which is why, you know, I sort of disagree with many of the concepts behind strategic missile defense. But I certainly think that the sea-based system works. I think the sea-based system has demonstrated itself that it actually does work. It works more effectively than the land-based system.
THAAD, the ballistic missile interceptor, and also the SM-3 have all been tested and proven and scored successful hits. All of them are about an equal phase of development. I would say that
they're really not forward
to that.
The sea-based system is actually forward to that. And it's going to be farther forward to that, and it's had more successes. And, you know, it's almost crazy to have this conversation, right? If you can put it on a ship, which is mobile, why wouldn't you do that rather than put it at land, right? You put it on the land, it can focus on one target. You put it on a ship, it can go anywhere. So even if they were close, why would you even have this debate?
That's why I support airborne laser, too. Why wouldn't you put something on a plane and try
Viewers at home, airborne laser basically means that we're flying a great big slow airplane very close to the enemy launch site and hoping that they don't launch surface-to-air missiles at the really big slow aircraft that's supposed to shoot down the missiles with lasers. I mean, that's as far as that program is right now.
I wouldn't describe it. I mean, look, it's basically designed for one country, for North Korea, and you fly it offshore at a very high altitude.
See, that's why sea-based DDG-51-based missile defense is so fabulous, because you can use it against many countries, not just one. Right? An Eastern European missile shield you can only use against Iran. A ground-based missile interceptor force in Japan you can only use against North Korea. You put missiles on Aegis destroyers, you put missiles on Ticonderoga-class cruisers, you can put them anywhere you want. You can go anywhere that there's water.
You know, look, I think at the end of the day you have several systems here. Mm-hmm. Each one of them, you know, nobody's shot down an actual incoming ballistic missile yet. And that is really the only way to prove that a missile defense system works. We have been going down several tracks and made huge investments in most of these. Actually, the airborne laser is the smallest investment of all, and that's the one that the administration has decided to basically totally kill. And I think, look, conservatives said, look, why wouldn't we go down these tracks? This is a critical technology. Let's develop it. Let's build it out. We've got these agreements. And now it's been given away for apparently nothing. If they deliver and they're able to get the Russians on board in a serious way, then look, everybody's going to have to tip their hat to them and say, oh, well, geez, that was really prescient. You were able to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, which is the goal. I, for one, am extremely dubious that's going to happen. And I think they're going to pay a very heavy political price for that.
Right. I doubt very much that they're going to pay a very heavy political price for that in Europe or anywhere else.
That's why we do it.
Right. And I suppose if the next election in the United States turns on missile defense, then I'll owe you a Coke. Anyway,
I think that national security issues, and this is going to be a big part of it. I would not underestimate for a second that I think in 2008. It was an election that never quite got to a national security argument. And I think in 2010 there's going to be a very substantial...
I would disagree, actually. I think in 2008 the Democrats simply made the more compelling national security argument. I mean, I think national security was certainly a critical element of Obama's victory over Clinton.
Having been there and having wanted to engage in a national security argument,
they didn't engage in your national security argument, right? Because your national security argument wasn't particularly compelling to the American people. But anyway, we were going to talk about fifth generation fighters. Do you want to talk about fifth generation fighters?
Sure. We can do a couple quick minutes here on fifth generation. So Inouye comes out yesterday and is still talking export. I would like to hear the left-wing case, the Democratic case, for why it doesn't make sense to sell F-22s to our allies at a cost of maybe $25 billion total in foreign currency coming into this country, providing good jobs, providing additional fifth-generation fighters in theaters where they may someday be extremely necessary. I would like someone to explain that to me.
Well, I mean, when you call me out for the left-wing case, I'm not sure I can present the left-wing case in, you know, sort of saying I'm opposed to this. You know, if the Japanese want to buy F-22s instead of F-35s, then we have to sell them to South Korea as well, and we have to sell them to Australia. You know, I mean, left-wing or no, I mean, your argument seems plausible to me. I mean, the only question being, you know, does this undermine U.S. security in some sense? But, you know, I'm not enough of a realist to think that we need to be really all that worried about Japanese defense preparedness or South Korean defense preparedness. And so, you know, I mean, I guess that I will fail to deliver the left-wing case here. I mean, the left-wing case would go sort of, you know, that these technologies will lead to an armed spiral between our allies or something like that. I think buying more F-22s is a bad idea for the United States, but, you know, if the Japanese government decides it's a good idea for Japan, then, I'm not really going to come out and say that it's, well, no, you can't buy these. This is a terrible idea for Japan. We can't sell them to Japan right now or South Korea, but, I guess I would sort of come around and almost agree with you that, you know, it's not a terrible idea. You know, if we do become engaged against North Korea, we don't really need F-22s against North Korea and MiG-21s, but if we become engaged against China or something like that, then Japanese and South Korean F-22s might come in useful. I wouldn't sell them to Taiwan, but I guess I don't have that much of an issue with it.
Well, you know, Taiwan's... I'm glad that we can reach an area of consensus here. I would, of course, like to see more F-22s for the United States. Again, there's an example of something where, for a few billion dollars, in what, frankly, I think the right made a very compelling argument that this defense stimulus was, you know, if you're going to go out and spend $800 billion trying to stimulate the economy, why wouldn't you spend a little bit of money on defense technologies? I think... I think that was a pretty strong case, but look, they decided to go another way. I don't really believe that the OB amendment is going to be repealed on F-22s being sold abroad, but I don't understand why it wouldn't be. I fail to see any argument, any plausible argument against it.
I mean, it's a technological diffusion. I mean, the reason they had it was technological diffusion, right? That if you start selling these to Japan, then, you know, I don't know, somehow, someday they'll end up in... I mean, I guess
that was the front argument.
I think the F-14 concern was probably... Because, you know, back when we sold F-14s to Iran, the F-14 was the most advanced tactical fighter that we had. I mean, it was very competitive with the F-15, but, I mean, it was a super awesome fighter. And then we sold it to one of our best friends in Iran, and then suddenly they ceased to be our best friends. So maybe that was the thinking behind it. And I guess I just trust
well,
the
that seems unlikely in the case of Japan or Australia.
Right,
but,
exactly.
I suspect that David Obi just, you know, my theory on this has always been that he didn't want to see those planes going to Israel, and the Israelis obviously want them. But I'm flummoxed by why the United States government, especially after you see the Joint Strike Fighter is being hacked by the Chinese. I mean, what are they really worried about here? I mean, you couldn't, you know, there are breaches everywhere in this country, let alone, you know, is it going to be that much worse over there? Who knows, but I would like to see another 100 F-22s in the Pacific, for sure.
Right, yeah, no, I guess I really don't have any problem with that. So what do you think, when we're talking about fifth-generation fighters, what do you think of the PAKFA, P-A-K-F-A, the new Russian-Indian fifth-generation fighter? Are people on the right concerned about this? Occasionally people will drift past comments and explain that we need the F-22 to kill the PAKFA.
I think that's probably not a really credible program. I would be surprised. I just went to a Hudson panel the other day where my friend Ruben Johnson, who is you know, really one of the country's top experts on Russian aviation, you know, he's dubious, and I'm not going to question his judgment on that. I think the Russians have such deep systemic defense industry problems that I just don't believe they're actually going to pull that program together in anything like a time frame that presents a real problem for this country. Where I do worry is about the Chinese, and they clearly have fifth generation aspirations. They've made that very clear recently, and they have the resources and the will and the motivation to really work on that. So when Gates is out there saying that, you know, in 2020 we're going to have 2,500 fifth-generation fighters and they're going to have none, and that gap only widens by 2025, 2030, which is what Secretary Gates has claimed, no one's seen any evidence of that. And frankly, I don't believe it. I believe that the Chinese are going to try. They may fail. They may fail to put together a fifth-generation plane, But you know, I think they're really working at it, and it's a sort of foolhardy to assume that they won't make it there unless they have some intelligence that. But nobody's presented actual any evidence that would indicate that.
That would indicate what?
That would indicate that the Chinese there's some obvious reason why they can't get to a fifth-generation plane by 2020 or by 2025 certainly.
Right. I mean, I doubt they'll have them in numbers by then. But you know, I agree with you. I think the Chinese. It makes sense for the Chinese to build one more advanced manned fighter. In the same sense that the Americans are building one more advanced manned fighter. Then again, the Chinese might just sort of try to skip that and try to develop air-to-air UAVs, which I think is going to be what's after the F-35, and which I think is going to be after the F-35. And I wouldn't put that past the Chinese either, because it might altogether be a cheaper and more effective program.
You know, the one thing you need for that, though, is you really need, you know, the total sort of air superiority and space
superiority. Fabulous command and control, fabulous and tremendous amounts of bandwidth to manage the whole thing. So it is very complicated. But you need that for fifth generation fighters too, right? I mean, the F-22 is effective, and the F-35 are effective because they're networked, right? I mean, they're better than current fighters. But what really makes them super better is
the F-22 has some problems in that department, unfortunately. Right. But that is the plan is that every one of these fighters becomes basically, you know, its own sort of mini AWACS platform, right, where that this is a battlefield commander who's managing assets across the field.
Right.
You know, that's their goal for this. I worry very much about the Joint Strike Fighter. I worry that this plane will not, in the end, be as capable because they're trying to do so many different things with it, that it, at least in the air superiority role, that it will be greatly inferior to the F-22. And I worry that timelines will stretch out, that prices will rise, that the amount of units that will be bought will collapse in the typical death spiral for these kind of things. And that at the end of the day, after cutting a plane coming off the production line at, you know, about $100 million is the marginal cost of each additional unit, there were studies done that showed F-22, if you bought 70 units, you could get it down to $70 million a pop. That at the end of the day, you're actually going to see a Joint Strike Fighter that costs significantly more than that. And that may not provide all the capabilities, at least in that range of an air superiority.
I think it'll be closer than sort of is advertised right now. I doubt that the JSF will ever be quite as much as the F-22. But you know, it is worth thinking here too that, I mean, if we go back to sort of your earlier concern about angering our allies, that, you know, that completely ditching the F-35 would just send all of Western Europe into a tizzy. Because you know, a lot of these countries, Italy and the United Kingdom and others, have based their defense planning around acquiring the F-35. So,
I think that's true, but F-35 has become a program that's genuinely too big to fail, and that is something that's worrisome because you got this program that has so much of the defense industry behind it, defense industry in every country, in every allied country. Is behind this thing, and these governments are pressing for it. And if I was a man who spent my nights awake worrying about the expanding power of the defense industry, this would concern me. And I made the case in the Weekly Standard that really, you know, this idea that Obama killing the F-22 is a major victory for government against the defense industry, I see it as exactly the opposite. That Lockheed and Boeing both refused to lobby the Hill on F-22 because Lockheed's interests were in getting the government completely behind F-35, and F-22 was the last remaining threat to the F-35 program. And so I actually think what Obama did was he did the defense industry's dirty work for it and killed the last thing that stood in the way of a $300 billion, maybe $350 billion program over the next 15, 20, 25 years.
Right. I mean, and you know, I just disagree on the merits of the fighter, but we can't really work out. I mean, this is one where time really will tell, right? In terms of the price and the effectiveness of the F-35. But you know, I mean, you make a compelling case. I mean, there's certainly reason to be worried about the F-35. So.
Well, is there anything else we want to get to, or want to wrap it up there?
No, let's wrap it up. How long are we at right now? Is that 40?
We're at 42 minutes.
42
so.
Minutes. Well, thank you, Blogging Heads viewers, for joining us today.
Thank you for staying with us through that. We might have gotten a little bit in the weeds there, but I certainly enjoyed it. So, Robert, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, take care.
All right, bye-bye.